I feel really silly giving this discussion because you all should be telling me how you live with CGD. But over the years that I spent having the pleasure of working with families who have CGD, and I do say families because it's just not a child that is affected, it's the whole family. There are a couple little things that I'd like to pass on to you that I think might be helpful. And that's really the gist of this. And I'm going to see if I can check this out. So, of course, we all would like to live longer than their memories and their bladders and the knees and the hips, the hearing and the eyesight. But, you know, we're going to live as long as we're going to live. You heard this yesterday, and I always think I have a bigger voice than what I have. My kids always say that I have a really big voice. So I can't stand behind a podium either. It's a really bad habit of mine. So you heard this yesterday, that it was called the fatal granulomatous disease of childhood. And I believe, standing here, just in the time that I worked with families with CGD, that life expectancy has even gotten longer just since I've been involved. And that really is due to the great work of physician scientists like Dr. Holland and Dr. Rosenzweig and all the other doctors that you've heard. And I'd like to also think that some of the nurses have helped a little too. So when I think about, you know, making the quality of life for families with CGD, I sort of see it as this inner working of all of this. And that includes, obviously, the medical side of it with medication prophylaxis, with an early diagnosis, which I think is incredibly key, strong mental health support, knowledgeable and accessible medical and nursing care, which was brought strongly to light yesterday when we talked about bone marrow transplantation, how important it is to find a site where there are individuals who understand CGD and understand transplanting CGD, avoiding potential infection exposures, and then, of course, education, which I think is really the key to solidifying success. Early diagnosis for many of you that I've met here, that has been a realization that you have been able to get your children diagnosed quite early. That isn't always the case, and we have many, many patients that come to us who do not get diagnosed until their 20s. Sometimes it's because they have suffered a significant and traumatic infection. And in the case of that, a lot of times we end up diagnosing siblings for the very first time. So again, affecting not just one person with CGD, but a whole family. So some of the things that also you might want to think about is, if there's not an infection as a part of the diagnosis, there are the granulomatous parts of the complications that I know Dr. Heller spoke about so eloquently yesterday. But I'm going to touch on a couple of the other granulomatous complications that he didn't talk about, because these are important in terms of weight gain and growth. And if we can get that diagnosed early, and we have diagnosed children as young as 2 with granulomatous colitis, we can see that their growth curve does catch up a little bit more. We see that they have better learning, and they meet their developmental milestones a lot better. And, of course, be any antibiotic prophylaxis. Again, this is maybe a little repetitive of what you've already heard, that the average age for an X-linked affected child is about 2 to 3 years old, and that's because they tend to present with significant infections very early. For the recessive forms, they can go as old as the 20s, as we talked about. So again, just reminding you about the granulomatous complications, which I think are just as significant as the infections. You see those in the GI tract, the urinary tract, the eyes, and the skin. And about 50% of all patients with CGD will have some sort of granulomatous complication. So just to remind you about the GI tract, rectal disease is the most common that we see, but it can affect any parts of the colon. And I know Dr. Heller showed some pretty significant and painful-looking slides yesterday. What we see clinically, oftentimes, especially in young children, is constipation will be the biggest complaint. And when that presents to a pediatrician, there is oftentimes a question whether they're just not wanting to poop, rather not being able to poop. And so they will try things like mineral oil or other laxatives, and it just really doesn't work. But what we also notice are some subtle things, like something called the albumin, which is a blood test that gives you an idea of the amount of protein that's in the blood. And if it's on the lower side, we always worry about, could this be a malabsorption issue with granulomatous colitis? It could also be an indication of a subtle infection as well. And just to show you, there, it can also affect swallowing. We have patients with CGD who can develop what we call diverticula, where they actually have outpatching of their esophagus, where food particles can actually get stuck in there, and they can feel like they can't swallow. And that is will usually be, they'll throw up food that looks like it has never even been digested. Or they'll complain that feels like something's stuck. And also, the outlet from the stomach to the small intestine called the pylorus can become very thickened. And what you'll notice is what Dr. Heller said yesterday, a lot of vomiting, a lot of discomfort, a lot of belching. And for small children, infants, sometimes this can be just attributed to some dyspepsia that infants can get. But if they become more constant and more concerning, this may be the issue. And then there are bladder complications, and I can't tell you how many phone calls that I've gotten from patients who tell me that, you know, they went to their doctor because they were having trouble urinating, they never felt like they emptied their bladder well, and so they went and they got a urine test, and the urine test was negative for infection, but the doctor, you know, or the nurse practitioner or whoever they saw put them on an antibiotic, but they're still not getting better. And the answer is because it really probably is an infection. What it is a granulomatous inflammation in the bladder. And the inflammation can cause outlet obstructions from the bladder out to the body, to the urethra, or it can actually cause obstruction from where the urine comes from the kidneys into the bladder. And in that case, sometimes the kidneys can become swollen because they're not emptying, and could also lead to renal dysfunction. And we've had patients who've actually, you know, had a kidney that no longer was functioning because of this. The mainstay medication for all of these complications is prednisone. And if you've ever taken prednisone, you know why you don't want to take prednisone, especially at the kind of doses that we prescribe for these things. They get trouble sleeping, feeling jittery, being hungry all the time, being cranky. And that's maybe some of the reasons why, if you are a parent of a child with CGD and they need to have prednisone, they become an extreme nightmare for the period of time that they're on the prednisone. But it does work, and it works very well. In the GI tract, Dr. Heller mentioned this, there are other medications that you can take by mouth, or you can actually take as a suppository or an enema. And they are all either aspirin-like or steroid-like. So, taking precautions. I know that this was hounded on about using both an antifungal as well as an antibacterial prophylaxis, and as soon as your child is diagnosed, it's my expectation that based on their age and based on how they're doing, they will be started on both of these medications. And then, of course, there's the immunotherapy with gamma interferon or Actimmune. And when I saw this, it's, you know, time to take your morning medications, you know. Wonder why you've not been eating so much. And this, my point in this is that there are a lot of GI side effects that occur with every single over-the-counter or prescribed medication if you happen to look in a PDR or even listen to the commercial on television, which if you listen to the commercial on television, I don't know why anybody takes any medication, because the risk of dying or whatever is included in every insert, more of a cover your behind statement than really helpful. I know most of you are either on Bactrim or have a child who's on Bactrim. It really, the landmark studies for those suggested that infection rate was decreased from one a year to one in every 3.5 years. And I've noticed nothing scientific here, but for me, it seems like Children do quite well when mom and dad are really in charge of the medication. It's during those teenage years that we see like this rise in infection. And I have to think it's because they're not even getting in one Bactrim. You know, you ask them, when do you take it? Oh, I take it every day. Oh, every day. Okay. You check a level and it looks like they haven't taken it for a long time. And then Dr. Holland mentioned this. If you're allergic, there are lots of options for you, including just using the trimethoprim part of it, rifampin, or other medications called cephalosporins. And the benefit of choosing a medication like a cephalosporin, it might just be once a day, or with rifampin, things to think about when if your child gets placed on rifampin for prophylaxis is that the urine will change like a urine reddish color. All these medications have side effects, of course. These are the most common that I see with Bactrim. Complain that they're more sun sensitive and that they will definitely need to wear sunblock. And also, we encourage people to stay really hydrated when they're on Bactrim as well. Nausea, diarrhea are just two of the main things that I hear. But in general, I have to say most people who take the medication regularly do not have many side effects and really tolerate it pretty well. Rare is that you might see a decrease in the white blood cell count, or you might see abnormal liver function studies. One thing I didn't mention, which I should, is there are also granulomatous complications that can occur in the liver. And that's something that we might worry about if we saw persistently elevated liver enzymes. We may also be concerned if we're seeing that their platelet count is a little bit low. So that's another complication of granuloma issues that I didn't mention but are important. And you should stop Bactrim during pregnancy, and oftentimes you need to check with your doctor before breastfeeding. So the other arm of prophylaxis is itraconazole. And again, this is the landmark study for this was done by Dr. Holland and our team. And we found that it made a huge difference. At least it continues to make that difference for our patients. These are the typical doses. They can be in pills and or liquid. As same as Bactrim, Bactrim can also be in a liquid. Other azoles can be used, as Dr. Holland mentioned, but we don't have any specific randomized trials to tell us whether or not these drugs are better or different in managing infections or preventing infections. The side effects of itraconazole, and I have seen this, especially headache. People complain of headache, diarrhea, some nausea, and there are lots and lots of interactions with any of the azoles, and so it's important that before starting a new medication or discontinuing a medication that your prescriber knows that your child or you are taking itraconazole. And then gamma interferon. There's not a I can't say that every single CGD patient that I work with is on gamma interferon. For a variety of reasons, everyone has one, why they take it or why they don't take it. Primarily, I think the reasons people don't take it are constitutional symptoms of just feeling very fatigued. And other people will complain of having fevers with it, which kind of wears them out. And as an adult and you need to work and you need to be functional, sometimes taking gamma interferon just really interferes, forgive the pun, with life. For some children, the adults feel bad giving their children a shot. They don't want their children to get a shot. They feel like they are hurting their child. I mean, a lot of people who are against vaccines have that problem as well. So those are some of the reasons why people don't. But if you decide to, the injections are 3 times a week. We calculate it based on your child's body surface area. And it does require a prescription for the medicine as well as the needles and the syringes. A lot of advice that I've gotten from parents about being successful in giving the shots is using the very, very thin needles that diabetics use, that helps a lot. A couple other people have recommended taking an ice cube and numbing the area before, if you can get your kid to sit still long enough. And of course, if you're an adult, you can do that. There are all these numbing creams like Emla. I think I have this on the next one. That's like a lidocaine cream that you can put on. You can, you know, work with your child to actually give themselves the shot, which sometimes, you know, if you're if you have a cut, it's much better if you clean your cut and put your Band-Aid on than somebody else does. It always seems to hurt more if someone else does it. And one point about the injection site, it will sometimes be very red and look angry, but that goes away with time and it's not infected. It's important that you know that it's not infected. You can definitely pre-treat with Tylenol or Motrin based on your child's weight. And that really helps a lot. And in fact, what I've been told is over time, you don't need the Tylenol and the Motrin. The body sort of just gets used to it, and it's no longer needed. In that case, I have had parents who have used a recurrence of fever while giving gamma interferon as a tool for undiagnosed infection. I had one mom who would tell me every time that when her child was going along, not having any fever or any problems, all of a sudden developing fever, that would be her clue that there was, you know, a quiet infection going on. And that was true for that child and for some other parents as well. So just to keep that in the back of your mind, because, you know, our kids with CGD, they can run around with a big fungal infection in their chest and, like, nobody will know. They might have a little cough. They might just kind of look a little tired. And it's those subtle symptoms that usually, you know, you drag your kid in to get their chest x-ray or CAT scan. Most of you know this, but I just wanted to make sure if there was anybody out there who didn't know how to get a hold of gamma interferon, that going to Compass is the way to go, and they do have a lot of patient support, especially because it's a very expensive drug, and it isn't always covered. But this is like one of the number one FDA indications for this drug, so you should be able to get it if you have insurance. And I love this because, you know, this capsule carries whatever you need and then all the side effects that this medicine will give to you as well. So, you know, that's probably the size of a pill that we would need for all the side effects that are listed for any medication that you take, including Tylenol. To eat or not to eat, I get the question all the time. Can I eat with this medicine? Can I not? How many hours do I have to wait? What do I have to do? And this is what I've come up with. With Bactrim, there's really no food issues at all, whether it's liquid or capsules or tablets. I warn those folks who are old enough or who think they're old enough to drink alcohol, don't do it with Bactrim. You will not feel well, most likely. With itraconazole, you want to take the capsules and tablets on a full stomach and the liquids on an empty tummy. I have been told that drinking soda pop might help with the absorption of itraconazole, especially, I think, the liquid, and avoiding grapefruit juice because it does delay absorption, and that's very, very well known. And then how do you get your kids to take medicine? Since most of your children will be taking medicine for their lifetime, starting early and starting to give them responsibility should begin, as was told yesterday, about the age of 7. To make it a part of their routine, to not make it a big deal. This is just what you do. You take your medicine. And parental guilt is, like, out there, and kids just, like, sense it. And they know that they've got you as soon as they know. So making it very matter of fact, you know, take your medicine. Everybody takes medicine. No big deal. Will help. And if you can, when you're starting to feel bad or feel sad about them having to take medication, my best advice for you is to turn around and walk out of the room. Don't let them see it. Let them think that, you know, it's fine with you, you're good with it, it's not a problem. If they don't like the taste of their medicines, which you know, happens. There are, in your, I'm sure somewhere in your local community or neighborhood, there's a compound pharmacy that can do grape flavor or cherry flavored or strawberry flavored, whatever your kid likes, and you take advantage of those services. Sticker charts for young children where, you know, after they've taken their medicine all week and they get a pencil or they get a trip to the Tasty Freeze or whatever works is a great thing for medicine as it is for really, you know, anything like doing your homework. Text messaging for teens would be fun, you know, if all of a sudden they get a text around 2 o'clock, did you take your medicine? Love, Mom. Pill boxes to help them to keep organized. Straight talk, just being, when your kids are old enough to understand, just being very straightforward with them why they're on this medicine and what it will do to protect them and keep them healthy. And if you have Mary Poppins around, that always helps as well. Environmental hazards. As you heard yesterday, we give a free pass to any boy or girl who has to cut the lawn. They get a free pass. They don't have to do that. They can sit in the hammock and take a nap. Just kidding. But what's in mulch? You don't want to know what's in mulch. It gives you a whole lot of bugs in there. Leaf mulch, wood mulch, mowing the lawn, raking leaves, turning compost piles, repotting plants, hauling dirt, cleaning a cellar, taking a hayride, haunted houses with hay in it, are all examples of kids who've come in with really nasty fungal infections. And then smoking, you know, pot. Yeah. In this case, I imagine medical marijuana brownies might be the better choice. Not suggesting, but if anyone has one, 735 is my room. She'll be there too. It'll be a real great getting to know you session. And then the big problem of swimming, although I just heard this morning that the bacterial load in any place is bad, but in general, you want to avoid the sharks. You want to avoid still bodies of water where there isn't a whole lot of turbulence or movement of the water, like ponds or lakes. Avoid hot tubs unless you can verify its cleanliness, meaning it's your hot tub and you clean it. The ocean is probably fine, but you want to stay from what we consider brackish water, water that's standing still, maybe in a cove or an area like that. There are nasty, nasty infections that have come from that. And usually, if you can smell the chlorine in a chlorinated pool, you're safe. But you have to be able to smell that chlorine, which means that your kid's eyes will be totally red and pretty dried out. But encouraging kids never to swallow water when they're in any kind of public swimming area and to both rinse off afterwards and, you know, including washing the hair as well. Immunizations, really important to say here that there are generally no contraindications for immunizations for kids with CGD except for BCG, no BCG. But also I want to caveat that by saying if your child is taking prednisone for a granulomatous complication, make sure that your pediatrician knows the dose that they're on because that will affect their ability to get certain live vaccines, all live vaccines. Most important, if we could clone Dr. Holland, we'd put him in every state and every community, but that's not possible. So having a really good doctor to look after your child is not always easy. I know the IDF Foundation website does give you a list of folks to go to. Certainly being in contact with a large teaching kind of organization is fantastic and a great opportunity if you have it. Access to the internet so you can go to the IDF website, the Jeffrey Modell Foundation as well as another good source. And if you're looking for a research protocol, clinicaltrials.gov is a great place to go to look at what Dr. Holland and his colleagues, Dr. Malik and Dr. Rosenvig, are doing to treat CGD. And I know Dr. Powell is going to speak much better towards this, but I can tell you as a child with a different kind of a chronic illness, it's so important to have your mental health support, whether that be in a psychiatrist, along with a psychologist or a licensed clinical social worker or an advanced practice nurse. Finding ways to reach out like you're doing today is so important because no matter what I said in the very beginning, I don't have CGD. I'm fortunate I don't have a child with CGD. So I'm only saying to you what it's like over the years that I've worked with families, and I'm giving you their best advice and my best advice based on my experience. But really look around you because these are your family. These are the people that will really help you to make the best decisions for you and for your child. And so I really encourage you to look at support groups, look at blogs, and finally, respite care. Respite care is so important. And if you have good family members or good friends or communities like your church to give you an opportunity to not have to worry about the day-to-day things that you have to do with your child, and especially when your child is ill or going through gene therapy or a bone marrow transplant in the future, knowing that you have an extra pair of hands or eyes to be there at the hospital with you so that you're not so burnt out that you're hurting yourself. And there are lots of great resources. Obviously, access to insurance with the Obamacare, because I can't say the other long, yeah, the portable, yeah, that one. Yeah, I got it right there. That one right there. Certainly looking into what your state offers. And for some folks, especially our older patients with CGD, who because of their multiple infections may have a decreased lung capacity, which really limits them from working full-time, looking at short-term or long-term disability. And then looking at the supports, again, from non-governmental organizations like the IDF, Jeffrey Modell, and the Rare Disorder Foundation are all great websites to go to and to get educational support, to be able to contact other folks with diseases like yours, and finally to find the community research and medical support that you will need. These are some, you may be looking around the room, like, who's this? So this is Thomas's advice, and that's to keep believing in yourself and keep on dreaming. And as you see in front of him is this beautiful artwork that he does. And this is Earl, and Earl said, never give up. That's his best advice, never give up. And he is a father of three. And then this beautiful lady, Miss Carla, who's sitting in the audience, says, stay positive. And you see her sitting with her beautiful family. And finally, I don't have a picture of him, but this is a likeness. Nick H. says, know your disease, research it, and ask a lot of questions. Thank you.